Hello and welcome to this episode of the Newcastle Oral History Unit podcast. In this series, we're broadcasting regular episodes featuring some of the fantastic interviews that we've recorded in the last couple of years. Episodes will range from discussions about specific projects to conversations with leading international oral historians about their own practice and future directions in the field. We'd love to hear from you. You can get in touch with us at any time via email, where we're at oralhistory@newcastle.ac.uk, or follow us on Twitter at @NCL_oralhistory. My name is Sue Bradley, and this episode comes from a roundtable conversation that we had with Mary Stewart. Mary is Curator of Oral History and Deputy Director of National Life Stories at the British Library. The voices you hear are Mary, Graham Smith, Alison Atkinson-Phillips and myself. Mary began by explaining how she became interested in family history through researching her own for her master's thesis, which took her to New Zealand, before describing how that brought her to be working at the British Library.
Family stories and newspaper articles written by this chap, William McCaw, and all the kind of random places we've ever been to in New Zealand, everyone's got the same picture. So everyone's got the same family photograph. Most people have been, and I went just before I went to New Zealand, to this old crofter's cottage, which is starting to fall to pieces, and the land's just been sold for forestry, so I've been in touch with people again about that, where they've gone in and written their name on a wall. It's about a mile and a half, you have to walk from the nearest road, saying, I am the great-great-granddaughter of William McCaw, and I visited here on a date, and I found my grandparents' signatures there. So I wanted to work out a bit more about this guy, and he was really interesting. Shepherd, had 13 kids, which is why probably his wife looked so grumpy. Lived in this isolated area, wrote for the Dumfries and Galloway Standard, wrote in lots of letters about various things. Was a theologian, in inverted commas. His main claim to fame is he wrote this prize-winning essay, which was published called Truth Frae Mang the Heather, about his, it's called Why the Gospel is True. So it's his kind of reasoning about why there is an intelligent designer who created all this stuff, which is weird because I'm brought up a bit in a religious family, I'm not religious at all. And he wrote bizarre numerology stuff, all that stuff where you find numbers in the Bible, and there are still people, lots of people in America who still believe all this stuff. So I went to New Zealand. I got a wonderful grant from the Bamforth Scholarship from the University of Otago because I'm a New Zealand citizen as well, and I spent a year and a half there looking into this chap, trying to write an intellectual biography of him, and I had loads of cups of tea with lots and lots of absolutely lovely older relatives, which was also important for me personally because I didn't really know my grandparents very well. I lived in England, they lived in New Zealand. We had awful phone calls with a time delay. It doesn't happen now. My kids don't have to experience this where you will talk over the top of each other and you only have a chance to speak to someone or see someone in a very concentrated period. So I got to know all these people who knew my grandparents who lived next door to them. And so that was one of the most enjoyable things of my thesis, as well as getting really into Presbyterian theology and changes in his thought processes between the newspaper articles and letters he wrote after he migrated, his changing attitudes towards women and the vote, which was really interesting, lots and lots of stuff. And then I was offered to do be part of a PhD grant and stay on, a grant and have a PhD and stay on and do some more study there. And I realised that actually I didn't really want to be an academic. It wasn't what I wanted to do was something solitary. It's the fact being part of those conversations that was one of the most enjoyable thing. And also that although my thesis got a good mark and that was really nice, actually I wrote my thesis to be read by my examiners. But also I wanted my aunt to read it and not go, well, this is unintelligible rubbish, why would I read this? Because it had to be work for them as well as for my examiners. So, and hopefully it did. I've written some other bits around it. So then I moved back to England and I carried on doing what I'd done for temporary work before. I was medical secretary, and then this job came up at the British Library. So a friend told me, oh, we should look on jobs.ac.uk, see what comes up. So the first job I had was being an assistant curator and an administrator. So
where?
At National Life Stories at the British Library, thank you Sue, where I met you. And for some reason I knew I'd either done really well or really awfully in the job interview, because we had to do some in-tray tasks, and Rob Perks, my now boss and long-term colleague, said, oh, that's what I'd do. And I thought, well, either that's great or that's really awful. I don't know quite what you're up to. Sometimes Rob and I still would do the same things. Often we wouldn't, but that's hopefully why we've managed to work together relatively successfully for 12 years. So that's how I got into it. I didn't know anything about oral history itself. I'd done one cringe-makingly awful attempt at a recording with my absolutely lovely old cousin of mine who died a few years after I submitted my thesis, who had an amazing way of telling stories, and I went in not knowing anything about oral history. I'd never done anything in terms of oral history in my undergraduate or my postgraduate studies. Asked all the wrong questions with my own agenda. He clowned up. It was dreadful. I hope it's been, you know, it wasn't worth anything. It wasn't a good enterprise, and so I just put it to one side. Hopefully that wouldn't happen now. Hopefully someone would get, you know, some more introduction into how they could possibly do these things. So I suppose I was interested in not your usual sources for history, and I was interested in making sure that although it can feel quite dull, the processes that people go through in order to file medical records at that point, and then became filing archival records, means someone can make sense of it, someone can find it, someone can make use of it. Otherwise, the care that's gone into creating that recording means no one can actually access it.
In the next extract, Graham asks Mary about the pros and cons of collecting long, in-depth life story interviews.
It's two questions there about why that depth of interview. And then the second part of the question is, how do you make that discoverable? Again, going back to the sort of indexing.
It sounds so long, and the one long life story I've done with a fabulous woman called Peggy Roberts was 15 hours long, and it sounds so long, and then you actually start. And she was 94 and had all these interesting ideas about education. She lived through the war, she'd lived in Australia, she was really informative in kind of training kindergarten and nursery teachers. Actually, when you step through someone's life like that, it's not so long. But I'm also aware that apart from her family, I'm not sure anyone's going to ever want to listen to the whole thing. And that doesn't bother me, because if someone's interested in early childhood education in Tasmania, they're going to get an amazingly rich, detailed section of that interview that they can use. And now I'm doing more, now that the material's digitised and we're doing more, or I'm involved in more outreach work, I realise how valuable that is. If you were doing a 3-hour interview, the 1 minute on Australia might not really get you what you need for someone who's doing a particular project. And I know it's expensive, and I know it seems like a luxury, and I know it's not for everybody, and it's not how everybody works. So I'm never trying to tell people they have to do these long interviews. And some of them potentially are unwieldy in how long they are, but sometimes that's what that interview encounter needs to be. And there we go, that's just the risk you take, because if you try and curtail something into 2 hours, it just might not be that idea that it could be used in all those different ways. And I suppose that is the fact that I'm working in an archive, that I'm thinking in that way. And I know that not all projects have the ability to do that, because there's a particular research question, there's a particular driver for a community project that needs to capture stories in a particular way. But I do want to, as much as we can, get those ideas that you don't know the research questions of the future, you don't know how people want to think about these things, and you want to give as many possible opportunities for someone to come at that material. So
is 15 hours long enough?
Possibly not. How long's a piece of string? You know, you could always go on, and then the practicalities switch in, because I've then got to cost out how long it's going to take for someone to do all that, for someone to do all of the work for it. So it's a balance, isn't it? There's no right answer. And still, there's some amazing 3-hour interviews we've got within the collection, and I'm not in any way denigrating those. They're really, really good and really, really useful, particularly if someone's coming at something for a particular subject and that fits, they'll be brilliant for them. Our Millennium Memory Bank interviews are fantastic in the voices that we have. They're very short, they're uneven, the documentation's uneven, but they bring so many things, even though they're 2-hour interviews.
I was wanting to ask you if you can illustrate what you've just been describing about the value of long interviews and people coming at them, finding things, finding a whole range of different topics in them. Can you? Are there any specific examples?
So I've just finished a project that, or part of the project that's part of this big Unlocking Our Sound Heritage initiative with these four wonderful young black women scholars looking at our recordings from to create curated audio tours of the British Library inspired by an exhibition on the Windrush. And I searched through our catalogue for some very, using some advanced searches to find things where people talked about Jamaica and the Caribbean. I narrowed those down. They had about 60 interviews where people came from the Caribbean themselves or their parents had. And they were from across the collections. And that was some disability interviews. One of our Oral History of British Science interviewees was absolutely fantastic on this. And if that fantastic, you know, immunologist had only been asked about being an immunologist, I don't think we'd have got the amazing stuff that these young women surfaced and found and talked about and talked to them and then they talked to others about the pardon system of saving within the Caribbean community, about his dad being a bus driver, about the importance of the front room for him and his family. None of that would be there in the record. Yeah. So that showed to me again how interesting it is to do those longer format interviews. And also because I think the interviewee feels that their life is being appreciated in the round. And I think that might be an interesting thing for them. So one of the examples I used yesterday was Kate Domett talking about her grandfather, Roy Domett, who was the Morris dancer and the nuclear missile scientist. And I think he found it interesting talking about all of those strands of his life and his family life too. And she found it really interesting as his granddaughter being able to appreciate those things in the context he talked about them.
Here, Mary talks about her experience of working with archives and archivists and her take on the term active archiving.
I think, again, because I work in an archive, but I'm not an archivist. It's another level of fraud within my life experience. So I haven't come from that archival tradition, although I work with and help train lots of archivists. And I work alongside qualified archivists. So our archivist at the moment, Charlie Morgan, our assistant archivist, Camille Johnson. I've worked with fantastic archivists before, Elspeth Miller, David Govey. I've worked with really good people, and that's their worldview and how they position things. So I suppose for me some of this is just quite, why wouldn't you be active, and also why wouldn't you try and get the process of archiving and the thought of archiving in at the very start of the project, because just realistically you create so much more work at the end trying to untangle it all. So I don't think I've had a road to Damascus moment, because I don't think I was ever on a road where I was in a particular train where I needed that. So okay. I don't know if that helps answering your question.
I want to come back on that, but Sue's got a question.
What is active archiving?
I suppose it would be the idea that, probably a very traditional idea of archiving, that an archivist is merely an arranger and sorter of these pre-organised archives that turn up, and your job is not to interfere with them all. You might take out some paper clips and sort it in and catalogue it, but you somehow, the idea that you're not involved with it, you're somehow detached. And I think that goes back to the study that I'd already done, the idea that why on earth would that ever stand up, was the idea that I was totally involved in the history I was creating for my masters. That it was my family, and it didn't mean I couldn't be critical about the old grumpy old man I was looking at, as well as admiring him in certain ways. But the idea that you could ever attempt to have some kind of objectivity to me seemed completely ludicrous. Because even if you were studying the Anglo-Saxons, you've still got a reason why you're studying the Anglo-Saxons and why you've got a particular view on it, or you're interested in a particular area. And trying to somehow step back and not acknowledge that to me seemed crazy. So I suppose that's, again, why oral history seems so sensible. I was like, oh, people are talking about themselves here. They're saying, oh, I'm coming at this from this angle. And everyone seemed to, or most people, most articles I read, most people I talked to, that was just part of the package, having that idea that you're in the history you're creating and you're analysing. So the same for active archiving. I thought, well, of course you know. And then I went to some really interesting archives conversations and conferences in the first bit that I was at the library. There are people coming and talking from South Africa saying, what do you mean you're some kind of passive observer? You're taking in stuff from the apartheid era, which is loaded in how it's arranged and what it's collected and the people they are, even though it's documents and they might look so flat. How you actually make those available and catalogue them is infused with your own sense of the world and how that world works as an archivist. So, you know, I'm not... I just don't think there was ever that point where I had to think, oh, yes, active archiving is sensible, because I'd come from a different place, that it was just obvious.
In her role as oral history curator at the British Library, Mary is responsible for assessing the collections that they have. In this next extract, she explains how she identifies voices that are missing from the archive and how she works to address the gaps.
I think there is part of our job is within a national institution is trying to look at the landscape out there and see what voices aren't in there. And then part of the other part of my job, which I appreciate and is a complete pain in the neck as well, is the practicalities of how you get that material in. Because it costs time and money for someone to do a project. And if we run a project in-house, it costs... I know, because I do the blooming business plan, I know how much money I need to raise, I know how much we need to put in for all different types of expenses. So it's trying to marry up that idea of where in this patchwork and landscape of all these different voices we're missing something, and then how it's best to fill that lacuna, to find something that's going to fill that space. And I think it's important to know both, because otherwise, if you're just only in the practicalities, you could end up missing some really important areas of national life. But if you don't have the idea that it's going to cost some money and it can't all be for free, and you've got to make sure that people are paid, and you've got to make sure you've got enough money and resources to actually promise what you've told your interviewees and your funders, then there's no point doing the project either. So it's, and it, in the end, I think it makes my job quite interesting, but it also makes it quite tricky as well, because they're, I don't think there's any projects we've done that I'm disappointed we've done. I think they're really good. And actually, what I'm pleased about is I think people thought the electricity project might be quite dull. And actually, it's really, really interesting. And because we work with some fantastic interviewers, our interviewing team are brilliant, and some fantastic advisors as well within our projects, I'm hoping that we get the tapestry more or less right to pick up interesting voices. So the main issue you have when you talk to some people is like, oh, well, you'll just interview all the heads of the electricity boards. And you're like, well, no, clearly not. But then the other angle is, oh, well, you'll just interview all the coal, you know, the coal face workers. And you're like, well, that's not... So then trying to step back and think what pockets and areas you need to interview in to get something that attempts to get a cacophony of voices that probably will disagree. And that's when you've got a good project, I think. So that's the attempt. It doesn't always work, but that's what I think we're trying to do. And also working quite strategically where we can with community and academic projects, thinking this isn't a National Life Stories project, but there's, we've got more, some really interesting, particularly collections focused on disability, which are Heritage Lottery funded, but where they work, the partnership that we have together with that project has meant, I think, we've got some really amazing stories and interviews in the National Collection. And so that's been a really exciting part of my job, and I love that partnership working when it works.
So that's really about filling gaps. Is there any projects that are about correctives? So you've already got a collection, you think, well, actually, what we need to do is supplement this material. Or it's sort of got a, it's got a particular, it's only, it hasn't got that collection of voices, it's got a particular...
The collections I really want, and it doesn't fulfil my own political viewpoint, is I think we need to have lots more on grassroots conservatism. The oral histories that we've got and the tradition of oral history within the UK has mainly been the hidden voices, which is, you know, admirable, although those hidden voices now have their own agency sometimes and they want to do their own speaking and not be uncovered by, you know, well-meaning people. But it doesn't mean we've got not great stuff, but we've got so much left-wing stuff. We've got hardly any of, I think, working class, middle class Toryism that I think would be really important to have, because I just think it's not there. It's not a very particularly very sexy subject potentially, but that's a big gap, I think. And I don't think that's a project that National Life Stories would do. We've got within National Life Stories I think we sometimes might be perceived as, because we do quite a lot of interviews which probably be counted as elite, I don't think it means you shouldn't get the stories of people who are at that higher echelons within their industries or within their sectors, because that's also quite interesting. But I think, and I don't think, I think it's something probably would be need to be more community or academic funded, but I think that's a big gap that we don't have. And it's not always about filling the gaps, because that's also quite, that's a model to think about. But I suppose it's that kind of tapestry of voices that I'm hoping that we get. And some of our projects are more London focused, which is also, London is not the UK. But I think our job as well is to thinking that centres like yours are doing something that we wouldn't want to step in when we don't have those local connections and that local knowledge. So within our national projects, we're always trying to making sure we get the non-London voices. But for some projects, some of our city-based projects, there aren't any people who weren't working in the southeast, particularly for some of those things like the History of Barings Bank.
In this next and final extract, I asked Mary what advice she would give to academic researchers who are doing oral history-based projects and wanting to archive the interviews that they're recording. What kind of advice would you give to academic projects that are thinking about going out and recording interviews for a research project with the ultimate intention of archiving them?
I think very clearly what kind of analysis you want to do. Because if you're doing it for a research project, you do have a research question in mind. You've got to do the research you need to do to fulfil the needs of the research bid, the research council, the university, your own career expectations, all of those things. And I'm a realist, that's great. I suppose it'd be thinking how many recordings you could actually do well to appreciate and what's necessary as a sample. And for some people, there's a wider number of shorter interviews. And for others, I think there's more appreciation with some people that actually doing fewer interviews and researching them more in depth might give you and yield fantastic results. And I think neither of those approaches is necessarily wrong. But I think, I mean, the clear practical advice of that is talk to whoever's going to archive the interviews before you start interviewing them, which is what I would do for anyone, but particularly for academics, because then you've got to go through a whole load of other set of hoops and bureaucracy in terms of ethics approval, costing things, management of the data. But all of that's good, because if you think about it in advance, you'll end up with a better project, and you hopefully will be able to still, within that academic project, feel like you're doing the right thing by your interviewees. They know what they're being asked to do, they know why they're being asked to do it, they know there's a current research project and then there's this future archival, you know, use in the archive that might be of interest. And it asks a lot more potentially of the academic. However, I think it means that we're not going to hopefully end up with, you know, the digital equivalent of the filing cabinets full of shoeboxes of cassettes done for research projects 20 years ago that someone's going to probably start offering me at the library, and I'm going to have to start thinking, how do I deal with all of this?
Yeah, I would take all that on board, and I think you've got a good model there, but I think there are other models and people are doing other things for other purposes. So, you know, we might think about saturation, where we're actually after the same story so many times and we don't do any more interviews after we've collected those stories because there's actually no any point in doing it.
Yeah.
It's just a French model. But the other model I was thinking about, it was, you sort of answered it in your... The collection works because you can connect across the collection, and I think that's a really good example you gave. But sometimes with long life histories, it's actually one of the problems is actually making those connections. You know, that you can have a set of long life history interviews that don't connect together. You know, so, and one of the things about topical interviewing is that you're forcing those connections.
Yes, and I think that's why I imagine lots of projects whose primary purpose is a research question might want to do those shorter
topical yeah.
subject-specific interviews, and that's absolutely fine. As part of that, I'd hope they'd collect some biographical information as well, so someone could understand who's talking.
Yeah, but I think it's a must. It's an absolute must that has to be there for contextualisation.
Yeah.
You know, that's the metadata that you need to be able to...
But I think the metadata if you're doing the longer interviews, having that content summary, having an understanding of how the archive in which it's going to sit might be searched,
yeah.
And my job is trying to think and fight for maintaining a longer summary that's searchable across a catalogue that works, is really important.
This has been a podcast from the Newcastle Oral History Unit. Thanks for listening. We hope you've enjoyed it. And remember, you can contact us via email at oralhistory@newcastle.ac.uk and on Twitter @oralhistory_NCL.